Poll after poll shows that the majority of Australians agree that climate change is real, is a problem for Australia, and is one we want the government to tackle. And yet the transition to a low-carbon economy still seems stuck on pause, or very much in a work-needed-to-be-done phase. What is preventing us, really, from making that full transition? One answer is offered in a book released last year by the investigative journalist Marianne Wilkinson. The Carbon Club tracks the endless political, economic and scientific wars that have dogged Australia's climate change initiatives. I'd like you to hear again an interview I did last August with Marianne about her book. And for a broader discussion, we were joined by two people with insider experience in creating pathways to decarbonisation. Dr. Martin Parkinson worked on climate policy for both Labor and Liberal governments. He's the former head of the Department of Climate Change and, of course, of the Prime Minister's and Cabinet, and he's now Chancellor of Macquarie University. And Gillian Broadbent was the inaugural chair of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the CEFC. That was a body set up under Labor to encourage private investment of renewable energy projects. Gillian was until very recently Chancellor of Wollongong University. And I welcomed them all to the Saturday Extra Studios.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Hello, Geraldine.
Marianne, your new book homes in on what you call Australia's exquisite dilemma, which is that we stand to both benefit from the things which drive climate change, fossil fuels, and to lose from the effects those fuels are having. You know, if broadly that where we find ourselves in 2020 with this wicked problem staring at us?
Well, it is, but I would argue very much in my book that our profiting from the free flow of fossil fuels into the atmosphere is diminishing basically before our eyes at the moment. And this is also going to become a big problem for us. But you're certainly right. If you go back through the cabinet papers, if you go back through the debates in the 90s and at the turn of this century, it's everything is about how much we profit from the fossil fuel industry and how difficult and damaging the transition will be. That's the argument that's constantly put by the people who do not want to change or want to block policy or are frightened of change, that it will genuinely undermine the country. But I think Gillian and Martin will be able to add a lot on this, but I think that what's happening now is we're almost getting to the stage where we're going to be hugely disadvantaged if we don't move a lot faster than we are because of this toxic debate we've had over climate change here. We are stalled now at the moment on policy, I think.
And this is not simply a left-right divide, according to you, or a divide between the big end of town and everyone else, is it? There are also divisions within the left about the effect that a transitional economy will have on jobs.
Absolutely. And I think the big unions that have represented people in these industries, like the Australian Workers Union, like the CFMEU, they have a lot at stake here, and I think that's why people in this debate always talk about what's called the just transition. Unless you can bring people, especially workers in regional Australia, with you on this, you are going to have big problems. You have got to persuade people that there is a vision for the future here and one where good jobs will exist. And there has been a lot of work done in this area. But, you know, one of the things I discovered when I was doing this book, Geraldine, is just how much the politicians, when you talk to them, and the lobbyists, when you talk to them, talk about how easy it is to wedge this issue because you do have so many jobs at stake, and how those wedge politics have really dominated the debate in regional Australia.
Yes. Now, I'm going to bring in Gillian and Martin. Before we get into some detail, a very interesting conclusion that Marianne draws in the Carbon Club. For one of the world's most carbon-intensive countries, the scale of the challenge reinforced calls from growing numbers of business leaders, financial experts, farmers and scientists that climate policy needs to be at the centre of government decision-making, not left on the sidelines. Martin Parkinson, do you agree with that? Has it been on the sidelines?
Oh, Geraldine, it's absolutely been on the sidelines. And let me do a plug for Marianne's book. It's a great story of, or great history of the story of our experiences over the last decade. And it makes good depressing reading at one level, because it shows how clearly policy has been able to be wedged, that people who want to sustain their existing arrangements have been able to mobilise resources to stop any serious prospects of improvement here. But the politicians have variously times tried to put it front and centre. They've been the victims of those wedges, and now they're all essentially running scared of the issue. They know full well if they try and put it back front and centre, it's going to be a lightning rod for conflict within their own parties and across the political spectrum. And that's a really important message, that this is not simply a left-right divide, that there are people within both sides of the two major political groupings, irrespective of whether you're talking Liberals or Nationals or Labor, who actually want to take action. But there's equally people within those three parties who are opposed to action. And then you've got the Greens sitting off further to one side, and Pauline Hanson et al. Sitting off on the other side.
Well, you're very tough. You know, you're quoted in the book, and you're really particularly tough on the Greens.
Yes. Well, yeah, look, the Greens, if they'd had a strategy that said, we're going to hang tough and out of this, we will end up getting both a mechanism to reduce emissions and a more ambitious target, I would have said to them, you know, well done if you've achieved that. But in fact, the way they've played this is we've ended up with no mechanism to reduce emissions, and we've got a target that they regard as woefully inadequate. So I do not understand what they've achieved in the last decade or 12 years of their supposed commitment to taking action on climate change.
And Gillian, your thoughts on whether it's been on the sidelines?
Oh, I think it's a very toxic area, unfortunately, for each of the parties, and the Greens weren't prepared to compromise in any way to start on that journey. And that set us back and added to the whole environment where it's hard to find a path going forward. But we do need an energy policy which supports a long-term goal to 100% renewable and a smooth journey to reach it. We have a federal minister for energy and emissions reduction who does not seem to believe in emissions reduction.
I am going to come back to that because he is quoted, I've just got here in page 318, when he was quoted after the IPCC released its latest report. And he did say that the Morrison government was investing in fair dinkum, affordable and reliable generation. That's orthodox language, isn't it? That's what I'm intrigued by, as to how we move, if Marion's right, to a whole different debate where we get sort of different language coming through. Gillian, did you find that there was, at the CEFC, were you able to see that coming through or not?
Well, I think we all want reliable and affordable electricity, but we also want it to be sustainable. And what I did see at the CEFC is significant reduction in the cost of renewable energy generation and development, and emerging technologies which can deal with storage at scale, and a whole lot of different way of thinking. So we tend to revert back to the language of reliability and affordability without talking about sustainability. And the three requirements have to be met, in my view, and are achievable.
How much enthusiasm did you find in the big end of town for these sorts of projects that had that word sustainable attached to them, which would require some very steep investment, I would have thought?
Well, I think it's variable, but you'd have to say that the support at the big end of town now is at a much higher level than it was even 8 years ago.
And did that come from within? That, because clearly, if this is such a fraught debate and the politicians are so frightened of it in many ways, that must have come right from within industry itself.
I think it's come from within, and it's come from the investment community, where you've got institutional funds saying, what is your sustainability policy? And voting with their feet on if you're not indicating that you're ready for an environment where emissions are going to be more heavily controlled.
And even if this, because, I mean, we're talking very big money, and we're coming back to that in a moment, like really it's a shock when you really face up to the amount of money that's going to be involved in decarbonising, if we can do it. You know, they were up for that? They were ready to take to their boards?
They might sound like big amounts of money if you add them up globally, but they're small steps and they each have an economic assessment. And we found in energy efficiency investments, the returns were paid off within 2 and 3 years. Right. They weren't very difficult decisions once you did the economics and you looked at it.
Now, Martin Parkinson, in your time in the public service, you were heavily involved in creating climate change policy which did give the country a roadmap, you could say, for moving away from an economy based on mining. Do you think, looking back, that you acknowledged enough the fears that Marion described of the people who were earning their livelihoods from fossil fuels and trying to draw them into the debate so that there was a sort of a sliding scale of approach that gave them a seat at the table that didn't encourage them to behave to try to stymie everything?
Well, Geraldine, I think with hindsight, we clearly didn't do enough there. But let's be clear. What really happened, as Marion spells out, is there were a group of people who organised themselves to then exploit those fears. And I think the true message that I've taken out of this, and I've talked about it elsewhere, and including with you, is that we treated this as too much of a technical problem. Mm. That is, we have to manage this huge transition. And we talked in technical language about it, and we put in place technical solutions to help smooth the transition. So support for emissions intensive trade exposed industries, which are essentially the ones where the fears were most exploited. But I don't think we did enough. And I say this with the benefit of hindsight, I don't think we did enough to actually spell out a compelling vision for affected communities about what they could transition to and show them clearly how to get there. I think that's part of what's still being missed now. People have to recognise that Australia's distribution of resource endowments has shaped our industrial structure, and those resource endowments have shaped our population settlement. And so a lot of the places where action will fall, in the energy sector, for example, are areas where there is really only one major employer, either as an industry or as a firm. And so you can't simply say, we're going to sacrifice your region or your job for the greater good. You've actually got to find a roadmap that gives people a sense of optimism for the future. Mm. And I think that's the bit that was missing. And I see that as a political issue rather than necessarily one for the technocrats.
Yes. Marion, do you agree with that?
I do to some extent, and I know that people, especially people like Greg Combe, who was the minister in the Gillard government for this, this is one of the things he did take extremely seriously. And obviously, and he represented a seat in regional New South Wales that had a lot of mine workers in it. But I think what Martin's saying is right, that even though you can say this, you actually do have to demonstrate it. And I think we only have to look back at the 2019 election, when the same kind of wedging arguments that we saw in the 2013 campaign with Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd were reinforced with a vengeance in 2019 in Queensland, where you had these almost kind of absurd arguments about if you wanted to do anything about vehicle emissions in the country, you know, that you were going to stop people being able to have a proper car to go away on the weekend and go camping in. That was the level of the debate. But this sort of stuff was being played out, especially all through regional Queensland and in WA. And I think we need to get beyond that.
But someone's got to put a lot of political capital into this, don't they? They've got to go on the ground. Like you, I can think of a Bob Hawke or a John Howard, you know, who absolutely, just like John Howard did, for instance, with the gun changes, and Bob Hawke did, you know, sort of semi-constantly. That's what's required, isn't it? This could suck up all the oxygen in government, couldn't it? Pardon the pun.
Well, I think that it is required, but the other thing you've got to remember, Geraldine, is that with what John Howard did on guns, he had bipartisan support with Labor, with the major parties. And I think what Bob Hawke did in a lot of the economic reforms, as Martin and Gillian knows, he also had bipartisan support. That's, I think, where you've got to get back to. But look, there's one kind of fairly crucial point I'd make before we move off this. I think you also do have to have politicians who talk about the science, because we have a view in this area where we keep on talking about how we have to be hanging on to this industry or that industry to its dying day without transitioning. We have a sense that we can defeat the science of climate change. I think what's been proved over and over again, especially in the last decade, is we can't. And I think politicians on both sides need to actually talk about that.
Isn't it interesting? Because I see it's more they don't know what to do. It's more than it's not arrogance. It's incredible sense of impotence. Yes, Martin.
Can I just say I really strongly agree with that. Part of what we're seeing again is the politics of climate change stymieing government action. In the same way we saw the political class left behind when the business community jumped over them in the mid-2000s to say, no, we need to start taking action, you're seeing the business community do the same thing again. They're coming to the view that we cannot look to government for leadership. Why is that? Well, they recognise there's four risks that they face. There's mitigation risk, that is, if you're investing in long-term assets, you know, long-lived assets, and governments do eventually act, you run the risk of stranding assets with a large value that you can't get back. There's adaptation risk, and that we've just seen that with the bushfires and the like, which is you can have your assets destroyed because we haven't acted quick enough. There's reputational risk or social license from being seen to not act. And then there's a fourth one that hangs about in the background and we haven't really seen emerge yet, but I know boards are worried about, which is liability risk, which is as activist groups jurisdiction shop, they will at some point find courts that will be prepared to accept that the actions of individual firms have had a deleterious impact on individuals through not taking climate change seriously. And if you think about how courts have expanded some of those interpretations, that's a big risk. So firms are very much, there's a real spectrum here, but the firms that are front and centre in this really are very, very conscious of those risks. And they're what's being manifest, as Gillian was saying, by investors and communities and their own staff demanding that they begin to take action.
Do you think the pandemic has changed any of this debate, I wonder? You know, because there's been a lot of trust, I would argue, shown in government and science. Quite a different, and of course it's a very clear and present risk, I suppose, which we can see. But I just wonder whether you think, Martin, that whether you're comparing and contrasting the two dramas.
So I think there is an irony here, Geraldine, which you put your finger on completely. I think the trust in science and government has gone up significantly because of the way in which this has been handled. But if you think then about how it's been handled, the politicians haven't put themselves front and centre. They put the scientists front and centre. They haven't played politics and tried to wedge anybody until, you know, sort of recently around Daniel Andrews. And the public responded positively to that. They listened to the scientists. They saw that the politicians were acting on good advice. And they rewarded the politicians with significant increases in their approval ratings. And I think they should take that as a sign of how to move forward. The pandemic, though, creates another sort of, not so much irony, but massive opportunity, which is we are going to have to recognise we need to do different things now to dig the economy out of the hole it's in. And we have a choice. We can look backwards through the rearview mirror and basically do more of what we've done in the past, or we can look forward and use this as an opportunity to try and reposition ourselves. And I think, you know, you said we'll come back to the issue of costs. I think we've got massive opportunities here, and there are roadmaps that have been spelled out by groups like the International Energy Agency and the IMF for countries if our political leaders have the willingness, the ambition to grasp the opportunity.
Mm. Gillian, the costs are an issue, aren't they? I mean, the UK government wants to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and the costs of reaching it are positively staggering. You know, you're used to sitting around board tables looking at costs. Do they?
Well, I actually think it's far more costly for the UK than it is for a country like Australia, because we have world-class renewable energy resources. And yes, we're widely sparsely populated, and some of that adds to the infrastructure cost. But I don't think of it as a cost, as an investment in the future. And we want to position ourselves to be competitive in the future, to have smart industries, modern application of technologies. And it's that excitement about looking forward that you can bring people with you and say, this is an investment. Mm. I mean, one thing that COVID has indicated positively is that when we come to a crisis, we can invest and we can spend when we need to, because we care about our people and we need to get on top of this crisis. And we don't want to waste a crisis by looking backwards when we're determining future policies. We want to mobilise the public support, come back to science and government, and try and see a future where you can get a bipartisan agreement on this.
Mm. And just awfully quickly, Marion, have you heard anything exciting about the future for those regions who are one company towns and regions? You know, have you seen something that is on offer for them?
Well, I think there is a lot on offer, and I do agree with Gillian and Martin on this. I think that we are now looking at enormous opportunities in the regions. You just have to look at the sort of investments that have been made recently in Northern Australia by Twiggy Forrest and Mike Cannon-Brooks, about the big investments that are going into North Queensland at the moment, and that's into renewable energy. But what I find really interesting is the kind of work that Ross Garnaut and others are doing about the opportunity for transitioning Australian industry to be fired by clean energy. And there's been some very significant developments even in the last few weeks with people like AGL, BHP, trying to look at this idea of how they can transition their own industries using renewable energy and large-scale battery storage. These things are happening. And one really important point I'd make, Geraldine, is that, you know, if we don't do any of this, when it suits the industries, as we have seen with the car industry and other industries here, the big coal companies will walk away from thermal coal mines here. They will walk away from aluminium smelters that don't make money, and they will be out of these industries, leaving the Australian taxpayer to try and work out what transition we can do. So it's not a case that we have a choice here necessarily.
Look, thank you all. Certainly not solved, but I hope it's canvassed a bit better. Marion Wilkinson, Dr. Martin Parkinson, and Gillian Broadbent, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you, Geraldine.
That was Dr. Martin Parkinson, a senior bureaucrat, the former head of the Department of Climate Change and head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Gillian Broadbent, who was inaugural chair of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation after a long career in banking. And the journalist and author Marion Wilkinson, whose book, The Carbon Club, is available from Allen & Unwin Publishers.